Alex. He's ebullient, Naomi said. I don't know what ebullient means, but if it means Alex, it makes me tired. Holden started up the ladder to ops in the cockpit. In the shiny black surface of a deactivated wall panel, Naomi's reflection smirked at his back. He couldn't understand how belters, thin as pencils, bounced back from high G so quickly. Decades of practice and selective breeding, he assumed. In ops, Holden strapped into the command console, the crash couch material silently conforming to his body. At the half-G Ade put them on for the final approach, the foam felt good. He let a small groan slip out. The switches, plastic and metal, made to withstand hard G and hundreds of years, clicked sharply. The knight responded with an array of glowing diagnostic indicators and a near-subliminal hum. A few minutes later, Holden glanced over to see Alex Kamal's thinning black hair appear, followed by his round, cheerful face, a deep brown that years of shipboard life couldn't pale. Martian raised, Alex had a frame that was thicker than a belter's. He was slender compared to Holden, and even so, his flight suit stretched tight against his spreading waistline. Alex had flown in the Martian Navy, but he'd clearly given up on the military-style fitness routine.
"Howdy, XO," he drawled.
The Old West affectation common to everyone from the Mariner Valley annoyed Holden. There hadn't been a cowboy on Earth in 100 years, and Mars didn't have a blade of grass that wasn't under a dome or a horse that wasn't in a zoo. Mariner Valley had been settled by East Indians, Chinese, and a small contingent of Texans. Apparently, the draw was viral. They all had it now.
"How's the old war horse today?"
"Smooth so far. We need a flight plan. Ade will be bringing us to relative stop in," he checked the time readout, 40, so work fast. "I want to get out, get it done, and get the cant back on course to Ceres before she starts rusting."
"Roger that,"
Alex said, climbing up to the knight's cockpit. Holden's headset clicked. Then Naomi's voice said, "Amos and Shed are aboard. We're all ready down here."
"Thanks, just waiting on flight numbers from Alex, and we'll be ready to go."
The crew was the minimum necessary. Holden as command, Alex to get them there and back, Shed in case there were survivors to treat, Naomi and Amos for salvage if there weren't. It wasn't long before Alex called down,
"Okay, boss, it'll be about a 40-hour trip flying tea kettle. Total mass use at about 30%, but we've got a full tank. Total mission time, 11 hours.
"Copy that. Thanks, Alex," Holden said. Flying tea kettle was naval slang for flying on the maneuvering thrusters that used superheated steam for reaction mass. The knight's fusion torch would be dangerous to use this close to the Canterbury, and wasteful on such a short trip. Torches were pre-Epstein fusion drives, and far less efficient.
"Calling for permission to leave the barn," Holden said,
and clicked from internal comm to the link with the Canterbury's bridge.
"Holden here. Knight is ready to fly."
"Okay, Jim, go ahead," McDowell said. "Ade's bringing her to a stop now. You kids be careful out there. That shuttle is expensive, and I've always sort of had a thing for Naomi."
"Roger that, Captain," Holden said.
Back on the internal comm, he buzzed Alex.
"Go ahead and take us out."
Holden leaned back in his chair and listened to the creaks of the Canterbury's final maneuvers, the steel and ceramics as loud and ominous as the wood planks of a sailing ship, or an earther's joints after high G. For a moment, Holden felt sympathy for the ship. They weren't really stopping, of course. Nothing in space ever actually stopped. It only came into a matching orbit with some other object. They were now following CA-2216862 on its merry, millennium-long trip around the sun. Ade sent them the green light, and Holden emptied out the hangar bay air and popped the doors. Alex took them out of the dock on white cones of superheated steam. They went to find the scopuli. CA-2216862 was a rock a half kilometer across that had wandered away from the belt and been yanked around by Jupiter's enormous gravity. It had eventually found its own slow orbit around the sun in the vast expanse between Jupiter and the belt, territory empty even for space. The sight of the scopuli, resting gently against the asteroid's side, held in place by the rock's tiny gravity, gave Holden a chill. Even if it was flying blind, every instrument dead, its odds of hitting such an object by chance were infinitesimally low. It was a half-kilometer-wide roadblock on a highway millions of kilometers in diameter. It hadn't arrived there by accident. He scratched the hairs standing up on the back of his neck.
"Alex, hold us at 2 clicks out," Holden said. "Naomi, what can you tell me about that ship?"
"Hull configuration matches the registry information. It's definitely the scopuli. She's not radiating in the electromagnetic or infrared. Just that little distress beacon. Looks like the reactor's shut down. Must have been manual and not damaged because we aren't getting any radiation leakage either," Naomi said. Holden looked at the pictures they were getting from the night scopes, as well as the image the night created by bouncing a laser off the scopuli's hull.
"What about that thing that looks like a hole in the side?"
Naomi said, "Ladar says it's a hole in the side." Holden frowned.
"Okay, let's stay here for a minute and recheck the neighborhood.
Anything on the scope, Naomi?"
"Nope, and the big array on the cant can spot a kid throwing rocks on Luna. Becca says there's nobody within 20 million clicks right now," Naomi said. Holden tapped out a complicated rhythm on the arm of his chair and drifted up in the straps. He felt hot and reached over to aim the closest air circulation nozzle at his face. His scalp tingled with evaporating sweat.
"If you see anything out there that seems off, don't play hero again. Just pack up the toys and come home."
Those were his orders. He looked at the image of the scopuli, the hole in its side.
"Okay," he said. "Alex, take us into a quarter click and hold station there. We'll ride to the surface on the mech. Oh, and keep the torch warmed up and ready. If something nasty is hiding in that ship, I want to be able to run away as fast as I can and melt anything behind us into slag while I do it. Roger?"
"Got it, boss. Night's in run like a bunny mode till you say otherwise," Alex replied.
Holden looked over the command console one more time, searching for the flashing red warning light that would give him permission to go back to the cant. Everything remained a soft green. He popped open his buckles and shoved himself out of the chair. A push on the wall with one foot sent him over to the ladder, and he descended head first with gentle touches on the rungs. In the crew area, Naomi, Amos, and Shed were still strapped into their crash couches. Holden caught the ladder and swung around so that his crew didn't look upside down. They started undoing their restraints.
"Okay, here's the situation. The scopuli got hold, and someone left it floating next to this rock. No one is on the scopes, so maybe that means it happened a while ago and they left. Naomi, you'll be driving the salvage mech, and the three of us will tether on and catch a ride down to the wreck. Shed, you stay with the mech unless we find an injured person, which seems unlikely. Amos and I will go into the ship through that hole and poke around. If we find anything even remotely booby-trap-like, we will come back to the mech. Naomi will fly us back to the night,
and we will run away. Any questions? Amos raised one beefy hand.
Maybe we ought to be armed, Exo, in case there's piratey types still lurking aboard.
Holden laughed.
Well, if there are, then their ride left without them. But if it makes you feel more comfortable, go ahead and bring a gun.
If the big, burly earther mechanic was carrying a gun, it would make him feel better, too. But better not to say it. Let them think the guy in charge felt confident. Holden used his officer's key to open the weapon locker, and Amos took a high-caliber automatic that fired self-propelled rounds, recoilless and designed for use in zero-G. Old-fashioned slug throwers were more reliable, but in null gravity they were also maneuvering thrusters. A traditional handgun would impart enough thrust to achieve escape velocity from a rock the size of CA-2216862. The crew drifted down to the cargo bay, where the egg-shaped, spider-legged, open cage of Naomi's mech waited. Each of the four legs had a manipulator claw at the end, and a variety of cutting and welding tools built into it. The back pair could grip onto a ship's hull or other structure for leverage, and the front two could be used to make repairs or chop salvage into portable pieces.
"Hats on," Holden said, and the crew helped each other put on and secure their helmets.
Everyone checked their own suit, and then someone else's. When the cargo doors opened, it would be too late to make sure they were buttoned up right. While Naomi climbed into her mech, Amos, Holden, and Shed secured their suit tethers to the cockpit's metal cage. Naomi checked the mech, and then hit the switch to cycle the cargo bay's atmosphere and open the doors. Sound inside Holden's suit faded to just the hiss of air and the faint static of the radio. The air had a slight medicine smell. Naomi went first, taking the mech down toward the asteroid's surface on small jets of compressed nitrogen, the crew trailing her on 3-meter-long tethers. As they flew, Holden looked back up at the night. A blocky gray wedge, with a drive cone stuck on the wider end. Like everything else humans built for space travel, it was designed to be efficient, not pretty. That always made Holden a little sad. There should be room for aesthetics, even out here. The night seemed to drift away from him, getting smaller and smaller while he didn't move. The illusion vanished when he turned around to look at the asteroid and felt they were hurtling toward it. He opened a channel to Naomi, but she was humming to herself as she flew, which meant she at least wasn't worried. He didn't say anything, but he left the channel open to listen to her hum. Up close, the scopuli didn't look all that bad. Other than the gaping hole in its flank, it didn't have any damage. It clearly hadn't hit the asteroid. It had just been left close enough that the microgravity had slowly reeled it in. As they approached, he snapped pictures with his suit helmet and transmitted them to the Canterbury. Naomi brought them to a stop, hovering 3 meters above the hole in the scopuli's side. Amos whistled across the general suit channel.
That wasn't a torpedo did this, Exo. This was a breaching charge. See how the metal's bent in all around the edges? That's shaped charges stuck right on her hull, Amos said.
In addition to being a fine mechanic, Amos was the one who used explosive surgery to crack open the icebergs floating around Saturn and turn them into more manageable chunks. Another reason to have him on the night.
So, Holden said, our friends here on the scopuli stop, let someone climb onto their hull and plant a breaching charge, and then crack them open and let all the air out. Does that make sense to anyone?
Nope, Naomi said. It doesn't.
Still want to go inside? If you see anything out there that seems off,
don't play hero again. Just pack up the toys and come home. But what could he have expected? Of course the Scopuli wasn't up and running. Of course something had gone wrong. Off would have been not seeing anything strange. Amos, Holden said, keep that gun out just in case. Naomi, can you make us a bigger hole? And be careful. If anything looks wrong, back us off. Naomi brought the mech in closer, nitrogen blasts no more than a white breath on the cold night. The mech's welding torch blazed to life, red hot, then white, then blue. In silence, the mech's arms unfurled, an insectal movement, and Naomi started cutting. Holden and Amos dropped to the ship's surface, clamping on with magnetic boots. He could feel the vibration in his feet when Naomi pulled a length of hull free. A moment later, the torch turned off, and Naomi blasted the fresh edges of the hull with the mech's fire suppression gear to cool them. Holden gave Amos the thumbs up, and dropped himself very slowly into the Scopuli. The breaching charge had been placed almost exactly amidships, blasting a hole into the galley. When Holden landed, and his boots grabbed onto the galley wall, he could feel flash-frozen bits of food crunch under them. There were no bodies in sight. Come on in, Amos. No crew visible yet, Holden called over the suitcom. He moved off to the side, and a moment later Amos dropped in, gun clutched in his right hand and a powerful light in his left. The white beam played across the walls of the destroyed galley. Which way first, Exo? Amos asked. Holden tapped on his thigh with one hand and thought. Engineering. I want to know why the reactor's offline. They took the crew ladder, climbing along it toward the aft of the ship. All the pressure doors between decks were open, which was a bad sign. They should all be closed by default, and certainly if the atmosphere loss alarm had sounded. If they were open, that meant there were no decks with atmosphere left in the ship, which meant no survivors. Not a surprise, but it still felt like a defeat. They passed through the small ship quickly, pausing in the machine shop. Expensive engine parts and tools were still in place. Guess it wasn't robbery, Amos said. Holden didn't say, then what was it? But the question hung between them anyway. The engine room was neat as a pin, cold and dead. Holden waited while Amos looked it over, spending at least 10 minutes just floating around the reactor.
Someone went through the shutdown procedures, Amos said. The reactor wasn't killed by the blast, it was turned off afterward. No damage that I can see. Don't make sense. If everyone is dead from the attack, who shut it down? And if it's pirates, why not take the ship? She'll still fly.
And before they turned off the power, they went through and opened every interior pressure door on the ship. Emptied out the air. I guess they wanted to make sure no one was hiding, Holden said.
Okay, let's head back up to ops and see if we can crack the computer core. Maybe it can tell us what happened.
They floated back toward the bow along the crew ladder and up to the ops deck. It, too, was undamaged and empty. The lack of bodies was starting to bother Holden more than the presence of them would have. He floated over to the main computer console and hit a few keys to see if it might still be running on backup power. It wasn't. Amos, start cutting the core out. We'll take it with us. I'm going to check comms, see if I can find that beacon. Amos moved to the computer and started taking out tools and sticking them to the bulkhead next to it. He began a profanity-laced mumble as he worked. It wasn't nearly as charming as Naomi's humming, so Holden turned off his link to Amos while he moved the communications console. It was as dead as the rest of the ship. He found the ship's beacon. No one had activated it. Something else had called them. Holden moved back, frowning. He looked through the space, searching for something out of place. There, on the deck beneath the comm operator's console, a small black box not connected to anything else. His heart took a long pause between beats. He called out to Amos.
"Does that look like a bomb to you?"
Amos ignored him. Holden turned his radio link back on.
"Amos, does that look like a bomb to you?"
He pointed at the box on the deck. Amos left his work on the computer and floated over to look. Then, in a move that made Holden's throat close, grabbed the box off the deck and held it up.
"Nope. It's a transmitter, see?"
He held it up in front of Holden's helmet.
"It's just got a battery taped to it. What's it doing there?"
"It's the beacon we followed."
"Jesus."
"The ship's beacon never even turned on. Someone made a fake one out of that transmitter and hooked it up to a battery," Holden said quietly, still fighting his panic.
"Why would they do that, Exo? That don't make no kind of sense."
"It would if there's something about this transmitter that's different from standard," Holden said.
"Like?"
"Like if it had a second signal triggered to go when someone found it," Holden said, then switched to the general suit channel.
"Okay, boys and girls, we've found something weird and we're out of here. Everyone back to the night, and be very careful when you..."
His radio crackled to life on the outside channel, McDowell's voice filling his helmet.
"Jim, we may have a problem out here."
Chapter 4. Miller. Miller was halfway through his evening meal when the system in his hole chirped. He glanced at the sending code. The Blue Frog. It was a port bar catering to the constant extra million non-citizens of Ceres that advertised itself as a near-exact replica of a famous Earth bar in Mumbai, only with licensed prostitutes and legal drugs. Miller took another forkful of fungal beans and vat-grown rice and debated whether to accept connection.
"Should have seen this one coming," he thought.
"What?" he asked. A screen popped open. Hassini, the assistant manager, was a dark-skinned man with eyes the color of ice. The near smirk on his face was the result of nerve damage. Miller had done him a favor when Hassini had had the poor judgment to take pity on an unlicensed prostitute. Since then, security detective and portside barman had traded favors. The unofficial gray economics of civilization.
"Your partner's here again," Hassini said over the pulse and wail of Bhangra music. "I think he's having a bad night. Should I keep serving him?"
"Yeah," Miller said. "Keep him happy for... give me 20 minutes.
"He doesn't want to be kept happy. He very much wants a reason to get unhappy.
Make it hard to find. I'll be there."
Hassini nodded, smirking his damaged smirk, and dropped the connection. Miller looked at his half-eaten meal, sighed, and shoved the remains into the recycling bin. He pulled on a clean shirt, then hesitated. The Blue Frog was always warmer than he liked, and he hated wearing a jacket. Instead, he put a compact plastic pistol in his ankle holster. Not as fast a draw, but if it got that far, he was screwed anyway. Ceres at night was indistinguishable from Ceres in the daytime. There had been a move, back when the station first opened, to dim and brighten the lights through the traditional human 24-hour cycle, mimicking the spin of Earth. The affectation had lasted 4 months before the council killed it. On duty, Miller would have taken an electric cart down the wide tunnels and down to the port levels. He was tempted, even though he was off duty, but a deep-seated superstition stopped him. If he took the cart, he was going as a cop, and the tubes ran just fine. Miller walked to the nearest station, checked the status, and sat on a low stone bench. A man about Miller's age and a girl no more than 3 came in a minute later and sat across from him. The girl's talk was as fast and meaningless as a leaking seal, and her father responded with grunts and nods at more or less appropriate moments. Miller and the new man nodded to each other. The girl tugged at her father's sleeve, demanding his attention. Miller looked at her. Dark eyes, pale hair, smooth skin. She was already too tall to be mistaken for an Earth child, her limbs longer and thinner. Her skin had the pink flush of Belter babies, which came with the pharmaceutical cocktail that assured that their muscles and bones would grow strong. Miller saw the father notice his attention. Miller smiled and nodded toward the kid.
"How old?" he asked.
2 1/2, the father said.
"Good age."
The father shrugged, but he smiled.
"Kids?"
he asked.
"No,"
Miller said.
"But I've got a divorce about that old."
They chuckled together as if it was funny. In his imagination, Candace crossed her arms and looked away. The soft oil and ozone-scented breeze announced the tube's arrival. Miller let the father and child go first, then chose a different compartment. The tube cars were round, built to fit into the evacuated passages. There were no windows. The only view would have been stone humming by 3 centimeters from the car. Instead, broad screens advertised entertainment feeds, or commented on inner planet political scandals, or offered the chance to gamble away a week's pay at casinos so wonderful that your life would seem richer for the experience. Miller let the bright, empty colors dance and ignored their content. Mentally, he was holding up his problem, turning it one way and then the other, not even looking for an answer. It was a simple mental exercise. Look at the facts without judgment. Havelock was an Earther. Havelock was in the portside bar again and looking for a fight. Havelock was his partner. Statement after statement, fact after fact, facet after facet. He didn't try to put them in order or make some kind of narrative out of them. That would all come later. Now it was enough to wash the day's cases out of his head and get ready for the immediate situation. By the time the tube reached his station, he felt centered. Like he was walking on his whole foot, was how he'd described it, back when he had anyone to describe it to. The blue frog was crowded, the barn heat of bodies adding to the fake Mumbai temperature and artificial air pollution. Lights glittered and flashed in seizure-inducing display. Tables curved and undulated, the backlight making them seem darker than merely black. Music moved through the air with a physical presence, each beat a little concussion. Hassini, standing in a clot of steroid-enhanced bouncers and underdressed serving girls, caught Miller's eyes and nodded toward the back. Miller didn't acknowledge anything. He just turned and made his way through the crowd. Port bars were always volatile. Miller was careful not to bump into anyone if he could help it. When he had to choose, he'd run into Belters before inner planet types, women before men. His face was a constant, mild apology. Havelock was sitting alone, with one thick hand wrapping a fluted glass. When Miller sat down beside him, Havelock turned toward him, ready to take offense, nostrils flared and eyes wide. Then the surprise registered. Then something like sullen shame. "Miller," he said. In the tunnels outside, he would have been shouting. Here it was barely enough to carry as far as Miller's chair. "What are you doing here?"
"Nothing much to do at the hole," Miller said. "Thought I'd come pick a fight."
"Good night for it," Havelock said. It was true. Even in the bars that catered to inner planet types, the mix was rarely better than one Earther or Martian in 10. Squinting out at the crowd, Miller saw that the short, stocky men and women were nearer a third.
"Ship come in?" he asked.
"Yeah."
"EMCN?"
he asked. The Earth-Mars Coalition Navy often passed through Ceres on its way to Saturn, Jupiter, and the stations of the belt, but Miller hadn't been paying enough attention to the relative position of the planets to know where the orbits all stood. Havelock shook his head.
"Corporate security rotating out of Eros," he said. "Protogen, I think."
A serving girl appeared at Miller's side, tattoos gliding over her skin, her teeth glowing in the black light. Miller took the drink she offered him, though he hadn't ordered. Soda water.
"You know," Miller said, leaning close enough to Havelock that even his normal conversational voice would reach the man, "it doesn't matter how many of their asses you kick. Shadid's still not going to like you."
Havelock snapped to stare at Miller, the anger in his eyes barely covering the shame and hurt.
"It's true," Miller said.
Havelock rose, lurching to his feet and headed for the door. He was trying to stomp, but in the Ceres spin gravity and his inebriated state, he misjudged. It looked like he was hopping. Miller, glass in hand, slid through the crowd in Havelock's wake, calming with a smile and a shrug the affronted faces that his partner left behind him. The common tunnels down near the port had a layer of grime and grease to them that air scrubbers and astringent cleaners could never quite master. Havelock walked out, shoulders hunched, mouth tight, rage radiating from him like heat. But the doors of the Blue Frog closed behind them, the seal cutting off the music like someone hitting mute. The worst of the danger had passed.
"I'm not drunk," Havelock said, his voice too loud. "Didn't say you were."
"And you," Havelock said, turning and stabbing an accusing finger at Miller's chest, "you are not my nanny."
"Also true."
They walked together for maybe a quarter of a kilometer. The bright LED signs beckoned. Brothels and shooting galleries, coffee bars and poetry clubs, casinos and show fights. The air smelled like piss and old food. Havelock began to slow, his shoulders coming down from around his ears.
"I worked homicide in Tarrytown," Havelock said. "I did 3 years vice at L-5. Do you have any idea what that was like? They were shipping kids out of there. And I'm one of three guys that stopped it. I'm a good cop."
"Yes, you are."
"I'm damn good."
"You are."
They walked past a noodle bar, a coffin hotel, a public terminal, its displays running a free news feed. "Communication problems plague Phoebe Science Station. New Andreas K game net $6 billion in 4 hours. No deal in Mars. Belt titanium contract." The screens glowed in Havelock's eyes, but he was staring past them.
"I'm a damn good cop," he said again.
Then a moment later,
"So what the hell?"
"It's not about you," Miller said. "People look at you, they don't see Dmitri Havelock, good cop. They see Earth.
That's crap. I was 8 years in the orbitals and on Mars before I ever shipped out here. I worked on Earth maybe 6 months total.
Earth, Mars, they're not that different, Miller said.
Try telling that to a Martian, Havelock said with a bitter laugh. They'll kick your ass for you.
I didn't mean... Look, I'm sure there are all kinds of differences. Earth hates Mars for having a better fleet. Mars hates Earth for having a bigger one. Maybe soccer's better in full G, maybe it's worse, I don't know. I'm just saying, anyone this far out from the sun, they don't care. From this distance, you can cover Earth and Mars with one thumb.
And I don't belong, Havelock said. The door of the noodle bar behind them opened, and four belters in gray-green uniforms came out. One of them wore the split circle of the OPA on his sleeve. Miller tensed, but the belters didn't come toward them, and Havelock didn't notice them.
Near miss.
I knew, Havelock said, when I took the Star Helix contract, I knew I'd have to work to fit in. I thought it'd be the same as anywhere, you know? You go, you get your chops busted for a while. Then, when they see you can take it, they treat you like one of the team. It's not like that here.
It's not, Miller said.
Havelock shook his head, spat, and stared at the fluted glass in his hand. I think we just stole some glasses from the Blue Frog, Havelock said.
We're also in a public corridor with unsealed alcohol, Miller said.
Well, you are anyway. Mine's soda water. Havelock chuckled, but there was despair in the sound. When Havelock spoke again, his voice was only rueful.
You think I'm coming down here picking fights with people from the inner planet so that Shadid and Ramachandra and all the rest of them will think better of me?
It occurred to me.
You're wrong, Havelock said.
Okay, Miller said. He knew he wasn't.
Havelock raised his fluted glass.
Take these back? He asked.
How about Distinguished Hyacinth? Miller countered.
I'll buy. The Distinguished Hyacinth lounge was up 3 levels, far enough that foot traffic from the port levels was minimal. And it was a cop bar. Mostly Star Helix security, but some of the minor corporate forces, Protogen, Pinkwater, Al-Albiq, hung out there too. Miller was more than half certain that his partner's latest breakdown had been averted, but if he was wrong, better to keep it in the family. The decor was pure belt. Old-style ship's folding tables and chairs set into the wall and ceiling as if the gravity might shut off at any moment. Snake plant and devil's ivy, staples of first-generation air recycling, decorated the wall and freestanding columns. The music was soft enough to talk over, loud enough to keep private conversations private. The first owner, Javier Liu, was a structural engineer from Tycho who'd come out during the big spin and liked Ceres enough to stay. His grandchildren ran it now. Javier the Third was standing behind the bar, talking with half of the vice and exploitation team. Miller led the way to a back table, nodding to the men and women he knew as he passed. While he'd been careful and diplomatic at the Blue Frog, he chose a bluff masculinity here. It was just as much a pose.
So, Havelock said as Javier's daughter Kate, a fourth generation for the same bar, left the table, Blue Frog glasses on her tray.
What is this super-secret private investigation Shadid put you on? Or is the lowly Earther not supposed to know?
Is that what got to you? Miller asked.
It's nothing. Some shareholders misplaced their daughter and want me to track her down, ship her home. It's a bullshit case.
Sounds more like their backyard, Havelock said, nodding toward the V&E crowd.
Kid's not a minor, Miller said. It's a kidnap job.
And you're good with that?
Miller sat back. The ivy above them waved. Havelock waited, and Miller had the uncomfortable sense that a table had just been turned.
It's my job, Miller said.
Yeah, but we're talking about an adult here, right?
It's not like she couldn't go back home if she wanted to be there.
But instead, her parents get security to take her home, whether she wants to go or not.
That's not law enforcement anymore. It's not even station security. It's just dysfunctional families playing power games.
Miller remembered the thin girl beside her racing pinnace, her broad smile.
I told you it was a bullshit case, Miller said.
Kate Liu returned to the table with a local beer and a glass of whiskey on her tray. Miller was glad for the distraction. The beer was his, light and rich and just the faintest bit bitter. An ecology based on yeasts and fermentation meant subtle brews. Havelock was nursing his whiskey. Miller took it as a sign that he was giving up on his bender. Nothing like being around the boys from the office to take the charm out of losing control.
Hey, Miller! Havelock!
A familiar voice said. Yevgeny Cobb from Homicide. Miller waved him over, and the conversation turned to Homicide's bragging about the resolution of a particularly ugly case. 3 months' work figuring out where the toxins came from, ending with the corpse's wife awarded the full insurance settlement and a gray market whore deported back to Eros. By the end of the night, Havelock was laughing and trading jokes along with the rest of them. If there was occasionally a narrowed glance or a subtle dig, he took it in stride. Miller was on his way up to the bar for another round when his terminal chimed. And then, slowly throughout the bar, 50 other chimes sounded. Miller felt his belly knot as he and every other security agent in the place pulled out their terminals. Captain Shadid was on the broadcast screen. Her eyes were bleary and filled with banked rage. She was the very picture of a woman of power wakened early from sleep.
Ladies and gentlemen, she said, whatever you're doing, drop it and go to your stations for emergency orders. We have a situation. 10 minutes ago, an unencrypted, signed message came in from the rough direction of Saturn. We haven't confirmed it as true, but the signature matches the keys on record. I've put a hold on it, but we can assume some asshole's going to put it on the network and the shit should hit the fan about 5 minutes after that. If you're in earshot of a civilian, turn off now. For the rest of you, here's what we're up against.
Shadid moved to one side, tapping her system interface. The screen went black. A moment later, a man's face and shoulders appeared. He was in an orange vacuum suit with the helmet off. An Earther, maybe in his early 30s. Pale skin, blue eyes, dark, short-cropped hair. Even before the man opened his mouth, Miller saw the signs of shock and rage in his eyes, and the way he held his head forward.
My name, the man said, is James Holden.
Chapter 5. Holden. 10 minutes at 2G and Holden's head was already starting to ache. But McDowell had called them home at all haste. The Canterbury was warming up its massive drive. Holden didn't want to miss his ride.
Jim, we may have a problem out here. Talk to me. Becca found something and it's sufficiently weird to make my balls creep up. We're getting the hell out of here.
Alex, how long? Holden asked for the third time in 10 minutes.
We're over an hour out. Want to go on the juice? Alex said.
Going on the juice was pilot speak for a high-G burn that would knock the unmedicated human unconscious. The juice was the cocktail of drugs the pilot's chair would inject into him to keep him conscious, alert, and hopefully stroke-free when his body weighed 500 kilos.
Holden had used the juice on multiple occasions in the Navy, and coming down afterward was unpleasant.
Not unless we have to, he said. What kind of weird?
Becca, link him up. Jim, I want you seeing what we're seeing.
Holden tongued a painkiller tab from his suit's helmet and re-ran Becca's sensor feed for the fifth time. The spot in space lay about 200,000 kilometers from the Canterbury. As the Cant had scanned it, the readout showed a fluctuation. The gray-black false color gradually developing a warm border. It was a small temperature climb, less than 2 degrees. Holden was amazed Becca had even spotted it. He reminded himself to give her a glowing review the next time she was up for promotion.
Where did that come from?
Holden asked.
No idea. It's just a spot faintly warmer than the background, Becca said. I'd say it was a cloud of gas because we get no radar return from it. But there aren't supposed to be any gas clouds out here. I mean, where would it come from?
Jim, any chance the scopuli killed the ship that killed it? Could it be a vapor cloud from a destroyed ship?
McDowell asked.
I don't think so, sir. The scopuli is totally unarmed. The hole in her side came from breaching charges, not torpedo fire, so I don't think they even fought back. It might be where the scopuli vented, but...
Or maybe not. Come back to the barn, Jim. Do it now.
Naomi, what slowly gets hotter that gives no radar or LADAR return when you scan it?
Wild ass guess here, Holden said.
Hmm, Naomi said, giving herself time to think.
Anything that was absorbing the energy from the sensor package wouldn't give a return, but it might get hotter when it shed the absorbed energy. The infrared monitor on the sensor console next to Holden's chair flared like the sun. Alex swore loudly over the general comm.
Are you seeing that? He said.
Holden ignored him and opened a channel to McDowell.
Captain, we just got a massive IR spike, Holden said.
For long seconds, there was no reply. When McDowell came on the channel, his voice was tight. Holden had never heard the old man sound afraid before.
Jim, a ship just appeared in that warm spot. It's radiating heat like a bastard, McDowell said. Where the hell did that thing come from?
Holden started to answer, but then heard Becca's voice coming faintly through the captain's headset.
No idea, sir, but it's smaller than its heat signature. Radar shows frigate-sized, she said.
With what? McDowell said. Invisibility? Magical wormhole teleportation?
Sir, Holden said, Naomi was speculating that the heat we picked up might have come from energy-absorbing materials, stealth materials, which means that ship was hiding on purpose, which means its intentions are not good.
As if in answer, six new objects appeared on his radar. Glowing yellow icons appearing and immediately shifting to orange as the system marked their acceleration. On the Canterbury, Becca yelled out,
Fast movers! We have six new high-speed contacts on a collision course.
Jesus H. Christ on a pogo stick, did that ship just fire a spread of torpedoes at us?
McDowell said.
They're trying to slap us down?
Yes, sir, Becca said.
Time to contact.
Just under 8 minutes, sir. She replied.
McDowell cursed under his breath.
We got pirates, Jim.
What do you need from us?
Holden said, trying to sound calm and professional.
I need you to get off the radio and let my crew work. You're an hour out at best. The torpedoes are 8 minutes. McDowell out,
the captain said, his comm clicking off and leaving Holden listening to the faint hiss of static. The general comm exploded with voices, Alex demanding to go on the juice and race the torpedoes to the Cant, Naomi chattering about missile jamming strategies, Amos cursing at the stealth ship and questioning the parenting of its crew. Shed was the only quiet one.
Everyone shut up,
Holden yelled into his headset. The ship fell into shocked silence.
Alex, pot the fastest course to the cant that won't kill us. Let me know when you have it. Naomi set up a three-way channel with Becca, you, and me. We'll help however we can. Amos, keep cussing, but turn your mic off.
He waited. The clock ticked toward impact.
Link is up, Naomi said.
Holden could hear two distinct sets of background noise over the comm channel.
Becca, this is Jim. I've got Naomi on this channel, too. Tell us what we can do to help.
Naomi was talking about jamming techniques.
I'm doing everything I know to do, Becca said, her voice astonishingly calm. They're painting us with a targeting laser. I'm broadcasting garbage to scramble it, but they've got really, really good shit. If we were any closer, that targeting laser would be burning a hole in our hull.
What about physical chaff? Naomi asked. Can you drop snow?
While Naomi and Becca talked, Jim opened a private channel to Ade.
Hey, this is Jim. I have Alex working on a fast burn solution so we can get there before...
Before the missiles turn us into a flying brick? Good idea. Taken by pirates isn't something you want to miss, Ade said.
He could hear the fear behind the mocking tone.
Ade, please, I want to say something.
Jim, what do you think?
Naomi said on the other channel.
Holden cursed.
To cover, he said,
about which thing?
Using the night to try and draw those missiles, Naomi said.
Can we do that? He asked.
Maybe.
Were you listening at all?
Something happened here, drew my attention for a minute. Tell me again, Holden said.
We try to match the frequency of the light scatter coming off the cant and broadcast it with our comm ray. Maybe the torpedoes will think we're the target instead,
Naomi said like she was speaking to a child.
And then they come blow us up?
I'm thinking we run away while pulling the torpedoes toward us. Then when we get them far enough past the cant, we can kill the comm ray and try to hide behind the asteroid, Naomi said.
Won't work, Holden said with a sigh. They follow the targeting laser's scatter for general guidance, but they also take telescope shots of the target on acquisition. They'll take one look at us and know we aren't their target.
Isn't it worth a shot?
Even if we manage it, torpedoes designed to disable the cant would make us into a greasy stretch of vacuum.
All right, Naomi said. What else have we got?
Nothing. Very smart boys in the naval labs have already thought of everything we are going to think of in the next 8 minutes, Holden said.
Saying it out loud meant admitting it to himself.
Then what are we doing here, Jim? Naomi asked.
7 minutes, Becca said, her voice still eerily calm.
Let's get there. Maybe we can get some people off the ship after it's hit. Help with damage control, Holden said. Alex, got that plot figured out?
Roger that, XO. Bleeding G, burning flip laid in. Angled approach course so our torch won't burn a hole in the cant.
Time to rock and roll? Alex replied.
Yeah, Naomi, get your people strapped in for high G, Holden said, then opened up a channel to Captain McDowell.
Captain, we're coming in hot. Try to survive, and we'll have the night on station for pickup, or to help with damage control.
Roger,
McDowell said, and killed the line. Holden opened up his channel to Ade again.
Ade, we're going to burn hard, so I won't be talking, but leave this channel open for me, okay? Tell me what's happening.
Hell, hum. Humming is nice. I just really need to hear you're all right.
Okay, Jim, Ade said.
She didn't hum, but she left the channel open. He could hear her breathing.
Alex began the countdown over the general calm. Holden checked the straps on his crash couch and palmed the button that started the juice. A dozen needles stuck into his back through membranes in his suit. His heart shuddered, and chemical bands of iron gripped his brain. His spine went dead cold.
and his face flushed like a radiation burn. He pounded a fist into the arm of the crash couch. He hated this part, but the next one was worse. On the general comm, Alex whooped as the drugs hit his system. Below decks, the others were getting the drugs that kept them from dying, but kept them sedated through the worst of it. Alex said,
"One."
And Holden weighed 500 kilos. The nerves at the back of his eye socket screamed at the massive load of his eyeballs. His testicles crushed themselves against his thighs. He concentrated on not swallowing his tongue. Around him, the ship creaked and groaned. There was a disconcerting bang from below decks, but nothing on his panel went red. The Knight's torch drive could deliver a lot of thrust, but at the cost of a prodigious fuel burn rate. But if they could save the Cant, it wouldn't matter. Over the blood pounding in his ears, Holden could hear Ade's gentle breathing and the click of her keyboard. He wished he could just go to sleep to that sound, but the juice was singing and burning in his blood. He was more awake than he'd ever been. "Yes, sir," Ade said over the comm. It took Holden a second to realize she was talking to McDowell. He turned up the volume to hear what the captain was saying.
"The main's online, full power."
"We're fully loaded, sir. If we try to burn that hard, we'll tear the drive right off the mounts," Ade replied.
McDowell must have asked her to fire up the Epstein.
"Mr. Tukunbo,"
McDowell said,
"we have 4 minutes. If you break it, I won't bill you."
"Yes, sir. Bringing mains online. Setting for maximum burn," Ade said.
And in the background, Holden could hear the high G warning klaxon. There was a louder clicking as Ade strapped herself in.
"Mains online in 3, 2, 1, execute," Ade said.
The Canterbury groaned so loud Holden had to turn the calm volume down. It moaned and shrieked like a banshee for several seconds, and then there was a shattering crash. He pulled up the exterior visual, fighting against the G-induced blackout at the edge of his vision. The Canterbury was in one piece.
"Ade, what the hell was that?"
McDowell said, his speech slurred.
"The drive tearing a strut. Mains are offline, sir," Ade replied, not saying exactly like I said would happen.
"What did that buy us?" McDowell asked.
"Not much. The torpedoes are now at over 40 clicks a second and accelerating. We're down to maneuvering thrusters," Ade said.
"Shit," McDowell said.
"They're going to hit us, sir," Ade said.
"Jim,"
McDowell said, his voice suddenly loud over the direct channel he'd opened.
"We're going down, and there's no way around it. Click twice to acknowledge."
Jim clicked his radio twice.
"Okay, so now we need to think about surviving after the hit. If they're looking to cripple us before boarding, they'll take out our drive and our comm array. Becca's been broadcasting an SOS ever since the torpedoes were fired, but I'd like you to keep yelling if we stop. If they know you're out there, they are less likely to toss everyone out an airlock. Witnesses, you know," McDowell said.
Jim clicked twice again.
"Turn around, Jim. Hide behind that asteroid. Call for help. Order."
Jim clicked twice, then signaled all stop to Alex. In an instant, the giant sitting on his chest disappeared, replaced by weightlessness. The sudden transition would have made him throw up if his veins hadn't been coursing with anti-nausea drugs.
"What's up?" Alex said.
"New job,"
Holden said, teeth chattering from the juice.
"We're calling for help and negotiating a release of prisoners once the bad guys have the Cant. Burn back to that asteroid, since it's the closest we can get to cover."
"Roger that, boss,"
Alex said. He added in a lower voice,
I'd kill for a couple of tubes or a nice keel-mounted railgun right now.
I hear you.
Wake up the kids downstairs?
Let them sleep.
Roger that,
Alex said, then clicked off. Before the heavy G started up again, Holden turned on the night's SOS. The channel to Ade was still open. And now that McDowell was off the line,